Mr. Manassian.
Thank you, Your Honor, Chief Justice and fellow justices. Your Honor, the Appellate Division's decision is consistent with every statute that's been mentioned here today, as well as the ruling in Morey. What the Appellate Division did is correct the trial court's finding of fact on a summary judgment motion, which is disallowed. There's no doubt that a police officer has a ministerial duty to act, a ministerial duty to render aid to individuals involved in motor vehicle accident. 59.5-4 does not change that. That's very clear in this Suarez decision. The duty to render aid to individuals in a motor vehicle accident includes not leaving them abandoned on a highway, as was done here. It not only includes that, but it also includes a duty to administer medical assistance, as what was seen in Prate, if required. A duty to investigate a motor vehicle accident and render assistance, as seen in Okinawa. A duty to administer medical assistance to an arrestee in Del Tufo. These are all found to be ministerial acts. This is not only cited in Suarez, but in Morey. In Morey, the court states that the negligence of a police officer in the performance of a ministerial duty is never immunized and is always evaluated under the ordinary negligence standards set forth in NJSA 59.2-2A. They are never insulated in the administration of their ministerial acts. In Morey, the court recognized this. It did not change the decision in Suarez or in Prate. It underlined it. It indicated the difference in those cases is these officers had a duty to respond to an individual involved in a motor vehicle accident. The court held that in Morey, the officers were asked to address a traffic incident, a disturbance where someone was in traffic. The court held in that case, the ministerial duty of the officer was to remove the individual from the roadway to the curb. Once they did that, they completed their ministerial duty. There was no need to render aid. This is not an individual stranded on a highway. True, he was intoxicated. So when after the court found that this is different from a duty to administer aid to an individual involved in a motor vehicle accident, they were asked, is there any other duties? And they were asked to look at 26:2B-16. Now, that statute was enacted in 1975. It was enacted in a body of statutes that were really addressing alcoholism. The state enacted a department of alcohol treatment or alcoholism that was part of the division of Department of Health. The court, what that statute does is it gives officers powers, not restrictions, but powers to deal with intoxicated persons. It indicates that if an officer finds an individual intoxicated in a public place, they may take him to his residence or to an intoxicated treatment center. If he's incapacitated, they shall. The argument raised by defendants that forcing an officer to act under the statute, which is not what we're alleging, would somehow subject them to civil rights violations, it was addressed by the legislature. The immunity in that statute immunizes police officers who take action under that statute. So if they take an individual away from a public place against his will, they're immunized for whatever happens. They're only required to remove an individual if he's incapacitated, but they have the right to do so if he's intoxicated. But in this case, Your Honors, we're not alleging that they were forced to do that. What we are alleging is they were forced to complete their ministerial duty to render aid to an individual involved in a motor vehicle accident stranded on a road. The fact that my client's intoxicated does not require them to remove this individual. And the immunity set forth in the statute in no way affects their ministerial duty. Again, it insulates their actions, not their omissions. Now, in More,
Mr. Nassian, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Focusing first on the Tort Claims Act, under the circumstances that we have in this case, what could an officer do and still be entitled to immunity?
Make sure that he's safe. They would be entitled to immunity if they waited for him until they realized that he was safe and then something occurred.
So what does that mean?
Well,
on a practical level, what would they have to do here? They waited 15 to 20 minutes. He refused to go with them. What would the officers have had to have done at that point in order to retain the ability to be eligible for immunity?
Your Honor, there is some dispute as to the amount of time that they stay. But if they stay, what they would have to do is they would, I don't believe there's any situation, quite frankly, that would, that there's not a question of fact that by leaving him on this particular bridge unattended would immunize them.
Help us understand what your position is on the scope of the immunity and the statute before we get to the jury question. Is it your belief they would have had to wait for 2-3 hours until someone showed up?
No, Your Honor. The reason why they waited more than 10 minutes is because when they called Officer Martinez, they then gave the phone to the intoxicated Hiram Gonzalez, who told them that he was on the Pulaski Skyway. After 10 minutes passed, they could have grabbed Hiram's phone again and called the officer and said, where are you? I'm where Hiram told me to be. You're in the wrong place. You're supposed to be here.
Is there any limit on how long they would have had to wait there as you understand the statutory scheme?
Your Honor, I don't know if there is a limit. I think that would be a fact question. I think a jury would then be able to determine, hey, they did all they could. But for this court to take that into it, to decide that question, I believe the facts are such that don't support a summary judgment determination. Could a jury find that when they weigh my client's actions and somehow find that he's negligent or more negligent? Sure. Could they find that the officers did what they needed, that an offer of a ride is good enough? They could, but does the law indicate that that's enough? Absolutely not. Look, when we look at the facts of this case, what are the facts of this case? 2:30 in the morning, they receive a call. It's a motor vehicle accident. Police photographs show damage to a vehicle, damage to a car rail. They get into the car. It's inoperable. Next to them is a half-empty bottle of a 1.7-liter bottle of Hennessy. My client is drunk. He's belligerent. A tow truck driver refuses to give him a ride, which is something that the officer said they've never experienced. When they don't offer to drive him anywhere, they offer to drive him half a mile down the road to the gas station. When he refuses to, they could have arrested him, but they would be immunized for failure to arrest them. They don't have to. They could have taken him elsewhere, but they have to still.
Could have arrested him for what?
They could have arrested him for driving while intoxicated, but Your Honors, they
were only not if there's probable cause. You can't arrest somebody just because you're trying to get out of a difficult situation. You have to have probable cause for an arrest. So if they concluded, and I wasn't there, you weren't there, as to what their observations were at that moment, that there was no probable cause to arrest him for DUI. How could they arrest him?
Well, Your Honor, I believe the facts in this case show there was probable cause. We have an expert opinion showing at the time that the officers met with him, his blood alcohol level was 0.2.
I'm sorry, respectfully, counsel, the officers did not have his blood alcohol content.
No, but the officers did indicate to Officer Martinez, you should pick him up. He's been drinking. He can't drive.
Okay. He's been drinking and can't drive is not the same as DWI. And
no,
so what you're saying is that the officer should have used a DWI arrest that they were not otherwise inclined to make for whatever reason, perhaps because there was no probable cause to arrest him, as a way of getting out of the difficult situation where you have somebody who is in potential danger but refuses to accept help. your solution there for the officers, and you've already told us there's nothing they could have done to make to get themselves into an immunized position. Your solution is arrest them.
Your Honor, that's not my solution, if I may. 2 points. I'm not alleging they should have, they had to arrest him, because I believe that under 3-5, they're immunized for failure to make an arrest, as well as under 5-5. However,
Your Honor, but you were asked by the chief, how long do they have to wait? Do they have to wait 4 hours, 5 hours? And your answer ultimately is they could, if he won't go with them, they can arrest him.
No, Your Honor, I apologize if that's how it came across. My answer to that is that's for a jury to determine. A jury can't determine they've waited long enough. A jury can't determine that they did enough. But I don't believe that it is something that is disposed of via summary judgment. We do have facts in this case that the officers realized he was intoxicated. We have facts in this case that the Rodriguez's saw him just 18 minutes after the officers had left, that he showed visible signs of intoxication. We have evidence in this case that Martinez was on the phone with him, was on the phone with Tucker. Tucker then gave the phone to hear him. Hear him, spoke to Martinez, and Martinez was able to determine he was intoxicated, heard him curse at the police, and believed that these officers realized he was intoxicated.
You said that they should have picked up his phone some period of time later and somehow used his phone. How can you pick up somebody else's phone? Presumably there's a passcode, and just use it to find somebody who they were just talking to. They would need his cooperation to do that.
Well, they did have his cooperation to do that. They asked him, could you call someone for a ride? He called someone for a ride. And then they asked to speak to the individual he was speaking to and hear him allowed it. And hear him gave, and the officer gave hear him back the phone. We don't have the factual scenario. We don't have a situation, Justice, where they said they waited for hours and no one came and they didn't know what to do and they didn't feel they could arrest him.
Let me ask you the question I asked your the counsel on the other side, and that is, does NJSA 26-2B-16 give officers the right to forcibly transport people who are intoxicated but not incapacitated?
That's exactly what it does, and it immunizes them for any actions that would come from that act. It definitely gives them that authority. Now,
In fact, that statute is basically consistent with the community caretaking function of police officers. You see someone drunk walking in the middle of a highway, you don't have to say he won't cooperate with me, let me wait until he gets hit by a car. They can actually put him in the car forcibly and take him to his residence or some alcohol clinic.
Exactly.
And they're immunized if they do that under the statute.
Exactly, Your Honor. And it in no way abrogates their duty to render aid or assistance.
Counsel, I want to ask you a question that I can't discern from the record. Did the officers leave him in a safe place if their car was not there? And I ask that question because I understand this is a bridge with a guardrail for a pedestrian walkway. But was there any area or was it permitted for any other car to stop or park on that roadway to pick someone up?
No, Justice, absolutely not. There was no clear path. That's a factual dispute. There was an allegation there's a bus stop there. And for some reason, we provided-
On the bridge?
On the bridge? And there was not. And we have photographic evidence in support of that. The path ends. It ends at a fence. Anyone would have to then pull back the signs as well as bend over the fence and enter the roadway. There is no safe path for someone picking him up to stop. There was an argument made, this is a police officer. He was an off-duty police officer.
Right.
His vehicle with sirens. These officers knew that, or were under the belief that an off-duty police officer was going to come on the bridge.
So it could have been a safe place to pick him up while the officers were there with their patrol car and its lights. But my question to you is, would it be a safe place to pick up once they had left?
No, it would not. It would violate the 39-4-97 obstruction of traffic. It would not have been safe. Okay. If they knew someone was coming there, they needed to wait to make sure that this individual could stop the car safely on the bridge. They could not invite that action without safeguarding against it. These are, I believe, fact questions that must be determined by a jury. Further, Your Honors, with regard to, the other statutes that are cited here, the court recently, they have a ministerial duty to act and to render assistance. That is not just one thing that, I'm not saying they had to arrest him, similar to what Your Honors faced and decided last month in Bayson versus New Jersey Transit. You had a bus driver who had a duty to protect its passengers from another passenger. The argument was made, they're immune for failure to enforce the law. He's immune for failure to provide a citizen's arrest here. There was no arrest here. That's not what's being, that doesn't, the fact that there's no arrest means it's not analyzed under that statute. And it doesn't change the fact that he still has this ministerial duty to render care. The good faith argument that's made is made under 59-3-3, which only involves what is involved. It's a qualified immunity when an officer executes a law. If they execute a law in good faith, there's immunity. If they fail to execute a law, it's absolute immunity. It's not qualified. These statutes don't apply. And Your Honors, I know it wasn't argued, but it was mentioned in an amicus brief, the application of the Good Samaritan Act. The Good Samaritan Act, again, only it immunizes actions and omissions in providing medical assistance. No medical assistance was provided here. And quite frankly, Mr.
The Good Samaritan Act doesn't use the term medical assistance or medical care. It talks about care. Am I correct? If police officers saw someone lying on a roadway and pulled them out of the way, not rendering medical assistance, and hurt the person, they'd be covered under the Good Samaritan Act, even though they weren't rendering medical assistance, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, unless under that section, they found that their actions were grossly negligent.
Right.
But yes, Your Honor. And remember, when that Good Samaritan Act was amended in 96 to include police officers, it wasn't quite as broad as the original act. It indicates that as long as they're not grossly negligent in administering these actions, okay, in providing this care. But it only immunizes those actions, not a failure to act. It's stated in Pray. It doesn't and somehow usurp a pre-existing ministerial duty to render aid. So, and since the enactment of that amendment, what have we had? We had the case of Avarisano, where an officer was asked to, there was an issue as to whether or not the officers initiated rescue missions early enough. They had a duty to act. They had a ministerial duty to act. The Good Samaritan Act didn't change that, nor in Ojinaka, where we had an accident. There was a duty to investigate the accident. The individual had been propelled out of the vehicle and was only 20 feet away. The officers had an obligation to investigate the area and see if assistance
was needed. Under the Good Samaritan Act, I take it that your argument is they started rendering care. They were acting as good Samaritans. They surely were when they put him in a safe place. but they stopped rendering care. And when they stopped rendering care, that's when they lost immunity of the statute. Is that your argument?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. I believe that it's, I think you have to read the statute's impari materia. And I believe that the Good Samaritan Act does not affect all care. I believe it's very clear. It's really addressing care, medical assistance. I believe that that's clear. And I believe we have to read these statutes together. That's what the original act did. And what happened
is treatment or care. That's why I gave you the example earlier of a police officer, or it could be anyone, pulling someone off of a roadway so that they're not hit by a car and injuring the person as they're doing that, saving their life. They're acting as Good Samaritans. They're rendering care there, not medical assistance. You're telling me that doesn't fit within the Good Samaritan statute?
No, I don't believe it does, Your Honor. I don't believe it does, because I believe that the Good Samaritan Act, we have to look at what it was really meant to address. And it was really meant to address providing medical assistance. And they did not leave him in a safe place. They were off the road with him in that location, and then they left. They didn't put him there. They were there. And then they left. You know, Judge, if the fact that he's intoxicated doesn't change their duty to render aid. You know, for instance, under 59:5-4, officers are immunized for failure to arrest someone or keep someone in custody. That's 5-5. But what do we see in 5-6? When someone is arrested for driving while intoxicated, an officer can release it from custody once reasonable precautions have been made so that the driver is released in a position of relatively safety and refuge following the arrest. Now, he wasn't arrested here, but what are we saying? That there is a heightened duty to address motor vehicle accidents and to keep the road safe, not just for my client, but for everyone else on the road. It could have been the Rodriguez's, who I represent here. They could have struck him and been deceased through no wrongdoing of their own, or Mr. Ahmed, who actually struck this individual. We would still be asked, we look at the actions of Hiram, but we'd also look at the actions of the officers. Did they have a duty to render care? Yes, they did. Is it ministerial and never discretionary under the plain language of 59.3-2? Yes. Did they properly do it? That's for a jury to decide. If a jury finds that they did all they could, or they didn't need to do anymore, there'll be a no cause of action. But this is not something that can be addressed summarily. To do so, we'll carve out a particular Hiram Gonzalez exception. And I don't believe that there's any support in the case law or the statutes to do so. I'm merely asking that this court do what this appellate division did, maintain the status quo.
How far does their ministerial responsibility extend?
Their ministerial responsibility extends until this individual is safe. Until they done all they could to make sure that he was safe. All right? Did they do all they could? They just had to wait a little longer. And if a ride didn't come, they could have made an inquiry. They didn't do that. They left. And they lied about it. They lied about it in their deposition. They said they called dispatch. They told them what was going on, and they were instructed to leave. They did not do that. They did not even tell dispatch that he was intoxicated.
You said they had to wait a little longer, but the ride wasn't coming, right?
Your Honor, apparently it wasn't, but they didn't know that, and they made no inquiry. This, I think, is really for a jury to determine.
Well, they have somebody telling his friend, he said his brother, but his friend, that to come pick him up. They don't know that the wrong location's been given, but it has been given. And you're saying they should have waited a little longer, but we know I think the facts suggest that the ride, they could have waited for 24 hours and that ride wasn't coming.
No, they it would have came. All they would have had to do is say, here, and where's your ride? And he could have called him again. And we don't know. And it's all they needed to do. They could have taken other precautions.
They could have called who again? They don't even know who they talked to.
They know. The person they spoke to introduced himself. Hiram knew who it was. They could have asked Hiram, where is your ride? And had Hiram called this individual again. We don't know that he waited for 15 minutes. That's not fleshed out in the facts. These are fact questions. And these are questions, Your Honor, Justice, that a jury may find were enough. But not for a court to determine. And there's a discrepancy as to what they said. They did not tell the truth at their deposition. They also said, told Martinez, that it's not safe for him to be here. But then they argue in summary judgment that it is. In their deposition, they say it's not safe. I quite frankly do not see how we dispose of this via summary judgment. Was a ministerial duty properly executed? The jury will have to determine that. Is there a question of fact as to leaving someone who, in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, is visibly intoxicated, belligerent, not listening to instructions on a stranded, dark, rainy bridge in the middle of the night? Is that fulfilling a ministerial duty, or is it abandoning someone on a highway, as in Suarez? They did not have to arrest him, but they could not leave him there unattended. That is our argument, Your Honor.
But just to be clear, you say they could have arrested him.
They could have.
And they could have forced him into the car without an arrest.
They could have. I'm not saying that they're
with no violate. That would not violate his civil rights.
That was putting him in a vehicle and transporting him would not violate his civil rights.
Against his will.
Would not.
I want to wait for my friend. I don't want to go with, I don't trust police officers. I don't want to go with you. And they say, tough, you're in, and force him in. That's okay.
There's blanket immunity for the officers taking that action under 26:2b-16.
Anything you'd like to add to your argument?
Your Honor, the argument raised is that this overturns Maury, but Maury says this is not rendering assistance to individuals involved in an accident. It distinguishes it. They argue that 26:2b-16 immunizes them for not putting him in the car. It does the opposite, but that still does not change the fact they have a ministerial duty, which discretionary activity is never allowed under the clear language, the last sentence of 59:3-2, and all of the cases that interpret it. For that reason, this is a case that respectfully must go to a jury. Thank you
very much. Mr. Andrews.
Thank you, Chief Justice and Associate Justices. In its simplest terms, I think this case should be decided on the fact that it is inappropriate for summary judgment, as there are material issues of fact which are in dispute. Additionally, as I interpret the defense arguments, they totally ignore the legislative intent and the statutory scheme of the Tort Claims Act that was promulgated by the legislature. The Tort Claims Act sets forth two different standards for public entity conduct. One, planning level or discretionary decisions, which are generally immune. And our case law, including this court in Coyne, in Justice Rivera Soto's decision, very clearly states what constitutes planning level or discretionary decisions. I believe the defense is misinterpreting what a discretionary decision means. A discretionary decision has a very specific meaning within the Tort Claims Act. It doesn't mean that when a police officer reaches a fork in the road, he or she exercises discretion by taking the left fork or the right fork. That's a ministerial act, just like what we have here. And the fact that they have to make a decision doesn't make it a discretionary decision, which is a very, very significant difference here. The cases are legion that the ministerial or operational decisions, which is what police officers do on a daily basis. They make multiple operational decisions, but they are not entitled to immunity because they are not planning level or discretionary decisions. The statute is clear, our case law is clear, and COIN gives us a roadmap as to how they follow it. Police officers on patrol are engaged in ministerial duties. The cases are legion. Ojanara versus the city of Newark and Suarez, which we have been discussing. Suarez, respectfully, is directly on point with Gonzalez. And the appellate division in this case, in a per curiam opinion, followed Suarez and distinguished Morey. Morey does not apply. It is distinguishable. In fact, when Justice Gruccio wrote the Morey decision, which was 10 years after Suarez, he said in section 4 of that decision, the difference between, referring to Morey, the difference between the present factual scenario and that found in Suarez is that the officers in Suarez were duty bound to render aid. Just like in this case, the officers in Gonzalez were duty bound to render aid. That is why Morey does not apply. And Judge Gruccio, I think, was prescient in making that distinction right there. And
so, counsel, there is 59.3-2 that deals with allocation of resources. And even individual officers may have to make those decisions. So, like in a hypothetical, they're there for 20 minutes, no one's showing up, and now they have a report of a burglary in progress. If they go to the burglary in progress, are they immunized or not?
No, I don't believe that they make discretionary decisions within the meaning of the law and the statute. Those are high level policy decisions where individuals in charge and have responsibility for making those discretionary decisions do so. I don't believe that a patrol officer who has an obligation to respond, because in this case, we already know.
No, he gets a report. The officer, look, I'm looking at 59.3.2, public employee is not liable for the exercise of discretion when in the face of competing demands, he determines whether and how to utilize resources. So he gets a dispatch, burglary in progress, burglar reported to be armed. You're saying that they have a ministerial duty to stick where they are and they're basically handcuffed from reporting to the burglary, even if they're the only patrol officers within the area?
If someone orders them to do so who has the capacity to make those high level decisions, I think that would be an argument that the court could acknowledge. But under these circumstances, I don't believe so. A patrol officer, with all due respect, doesn't make those kinds of decisions within the meaning of the Tort Claims Act. I understand they're making a decision that you would say involves discretion because they're given options, but that would involve any decision that a police officer makes when he or she
officer. We know that patrol officers are on the road and they're receiving all sorts of reports, and they may have two reports. One go here, one there's a robbery here, and it's a robbery there. You don't think those are discretionary? At that moment, you don't think that's a discretionary decision concerning allocation of resources?
Not within the meaning of the Tort Claims Act and the case law that we discussed, including things like COIN. That might be a high level decision that has to be made by another individual, planning level or discretionary decisions that again do not filter down to the ministerial acts when these individuals were required to respond. They were there. They were dealing with a situation that was very clearly a dangerous situation. We look at the scenario, what happened here, and according to the record, at 3:24 a.m., the patrol officers called dispatch to advise of the situation. We're left on a busy highway. This is a major artery. And at 3:44 a.m., Mr. Gonzalez is walking in the roadway and dead within 20 minutes. And I heard my adversary indicate on several occasions that the police officers placed him in a position of safety. Well, respectfully, no, they didn't. They placed him in a position where he was dead within 20 minutes. That's not a position of safety. You don't have to predict exactly what is foreseeable, but it is certainly foreseeable that an individual who is arguably intoxicated would do something like walk on the roadway. That is absolutely something which is foreseeable and would fall within the decision-making process of the jury. We also, and we've heard some conversation about the applicability of 26:2B16. That statute absolutely gives the police officer the right to place that individual in the car and take him to a place of safety. And what it does is it decides that if you as a patrol officer do this, you will be immunized for doing it. If something happens on the way, or if I get mad at the police officer for putting me in the car and taking me to a place of safety, that's immunized. But the decision not to act is not immunized. These officers had a duty to take reasonable precautions, and that's a jury call, to make sure that this individual was protected. It is entirely foreseeable that this type of tragedy would in fact occur. That's the basis of my presentation, Chief Justice. And if anyone has any questions, I'd be more than happy to respond.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Edelman, brief rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I will try and be as brief and as concise as I can, as there's been a lot said. Back to Justice Albin's point that he just made, the discretion is afforded to low-level patrol officers. That's their job. Without that discretion, they can't do their job. To say that only high-level decision makers, that it applies to, the discretion only applies to them, would not allow patrol officers to do their job. Like Justice Albin said, you can't be handcuffed to one person all night and possibly not go to the robbery. As far as lying to the police that are lying under oath, Officer Tucker didn't lie. He said he didn't remember talking to the Martinez. You know, and as far as talking to dispatch, they didn't lie about as far what they were instructed to do. Officer Tucker said a few times he didn't exactly recall what was said. He believed that he was told to resume patrol, but he didn't lie. I mean, he testified years after the incident. So I just want that to be clear that there was no perjury here. But there's been a lot of talk by the plaintiffs and amicus for the plaintiffs about the duty to render aid and reasonable precautions. But there's been no substance to that. We haven't been told what the officers could have done or what they were supposed to do beyond what they already did. I mean, at what point do the officers have the right to go and continue doing their job?
Mr. Edelman, what's your understanding of the scope of the Title 26 section we've been talking about? How far can the police go with an intoxicated individual?
My understanding is that they have an intoxicated individual. They assess whether they're intoxicated or incapacitated. They, if incapacitated, they have to bring them to some sort of center for treatment. If just intoxicated, there's no requirement to take them anywhere. However, they have the option. If somebody resists and does not want help, but yet is still put in the car, that can be considered a violation of civil rights, such as unlawful detention, unlawful imprisonment. So, I mean, those are 1983 violations. In other words, the officers in this case were damned if they do and damned if they don't. So either they, if they shoved him into the car or stayed with him, you know, they lose either way. And the immunities were codified so officers can have discretion to make these decisions. And frankly, to say that we need to go back to the trial court simply because a jury needs to make a decision is not correct.
Even 1983 has immunities. We know that's being debated. So an objectively reasonable police officer is protected under Section 1983. And then we have the statutory immunity. You agree there are immunities under the statute and there's immunity under Section 1983.
I agree, Your Honor.
Okay.
I absolutely agree. I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought for a minute. But I think what I was saying is that there has to be a point in time where the officers have the ability to use their discretion. Otherwise,
are you asking us, Mr. Edelman, to amend or adjust COIN? What was said in COIN? COIN, as Mr. Andrews read, is very clear that it only applies to high-level planning decisions, not to every choice decision that a public employee is called upon to make in the course of exercising and performing a ministerial duty. It's very limited, and one may not like it, but I mean, that has been the statement of our law.
Understood. I'm just asking the court to consider what Maury said and what Brown v. Brown said in terms of officers having the ability to essentially knowing that their resources as manpower are limited and have to be able to make decisions with the use of discretion. I'm not asking for COIN to be overturned or necessarily amended. And I also want to point out that the cases referred to by my adversary, which were Prate, Ojikana, Del Tufo, those were all car accident cases, but they involved situations where the driver or passenger or somebody was injured and required medical attention, which was not in this case. This case, the officers rendered aid. Once they rendered aid, that's what they're supposed to do, and that's what they did. And to go to a determination as to whether the immunities apply is a legal decision. It's a legal decision to be made by the court, not for the jury. So for the reasons I've already stated, it's our position that the petitioners are immune under the Tort Claims Act because of the discretionary good faith acts they undertook, as well as under 26:16-2B or 2B-16 for all of those reasons. So I don't want to get to, I don't want to start repeating myself, but if there's any other questions, I'm happy to address them.
Thank you, Mr. Edelman.
I just have one question, Chief.
Sure.
Are you saying that these immunities are not immunities that are a defense against an action, and that they don't go, if we were to decide on the basis of summary judgment that there are factual disputes, that you wouldn't have the benefit of having these immunities go before the jury? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying that we're barred from presenting these immunities to a jury. No, I'm not saying that.
Okay, fine. Thank you.
Thank you again. And thank you to all counsel for the very fine arguments.